Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt. How's Southern DMZ on this July day?
Things are good. I hope you can hear me better than Justin Green.
Justin did a great job while you were gone. Just the audio was screwed up, but we had a really interesting discussion about reform cons and immigration. So you haven't won him over on immigration yet.
Well, it's not going to happen. Sadly, David Frum was a bad influence on him, I think, and that corrupted his mind. But I was listening. I was at the Ritz-Carlton in Orange County in Dana Point, listening to the podcast, believe it or not, listening to you and Justin, straining to hear those really good points, which admittedly were made. But I am tanned and rusted, Bill, and happy to be back here.
Well, but you were a little busy yourself while Justin and I were talking. You were on Bill Maher.
Yeah, I did Bill Maher last week, and it was great. I was on with Liz Mayer and Cornell West, who called me Brother Lewis and hugged me three or four times, who was really a cool guy and had a blast.
He's nicer to you than Barack Obama.
Oh, what was that?
He's nicer to you than Barack Obama.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he wants to put Barack Obama in jail for war crimes. And I just, you know, want to, you know, impeach him. So we're a ways apart on that. But it was fun. And, you know, Liz Mayer, who's more of a moderate Republican, but a good friend, was on. And that was cool to have, you know, kind of two semi-conservatives. It was good parody there.
It's a little top heavy on the right for a Bill Maher panel, isn't it? I know he usually has one. I usually went, you know, two to one right versus left.
I'm told that it's becoming more the norm now than it used to be, and I think it's great. I mean, I felt I can't tell you just psychologically having someone else there on your, or, you know, ostensibly on your side. Liz and I disagree about a lot of things, including about abortion. But having someone there that you sort of know who's sort of on your team is very helpful. And the way the show started, Bill says, you know, who here thinks that that George Zimmerman is innocent? Or who thinks George Zimmerman is guilty? And, of course, you know, Bill Maher and Cornell both raised their hand, and Liz and I are sitting there with our hands raised. It's kind of like that thing, like, raise your hand if you don't believe in evolution or whatever, that famous debate thing. And I can tell you, having two of us there made it less awkward. The weird thing was, we taped it Friday night, and I said some stuff about the Trayvon Martin, you know, George Zimmerman case that sounded different when they rerun it 100 times the following week after the court decision. Right, so I've gotten some hate tweets and emails here and there. But it was a great experience. The Bill Maher people are really good to work with. They run a top-notch operation there. And I like doing the show. You get a chance to talk, and you're physically there with the host, and you're on for like 45 minutes. So check it out. They're replaying it a lot on HBO this week. But it was really, really fun. My second time doing it, and it's just really, really cool. Enjoyed it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, I saw on Twitter today, you are very agitated. I'm surprised, at least. You're agitated that Liz Cheney is trying to Bigfoot the incumbent Republican Senator Mike Enzi out of his Wyoming seat. I would have thought, you know, as a paragon of conservatism, you'd want to pick the more conservative choice in Liz Cheney and not some Washington insider like Mike Enzi.
Well, but who says Liz Cheney's conservative? I mean, we know she's like we know she's a war hawk, a neocon, but I mean, how could
we know she's a jerk? Like, isn't that enough to know?
Well, she's loud and tough, but look, I mean, you know, she's, and you say Mike Enzi's establishment. I mean, she's Dick Cheney's daughter. If her name was Liz Lewis, I don't think she would be running for the U.S. Senate, not without taking a pit stop in, say, the state house or the state Senate. And that's my thing. Look, she moves, you know, she's obviously worked in the State Department. She's obviously very smart. But look, she's Dick Cheney's daughter. And she moves into the state and
you are anti-dynasty. That's not inconsistent for you.
No, I am on the record as being anti-dynasty. And look, I mean, this all goes back to we live in a world where I fully expect someday for, you know, Tag Romney and George P. Bush to challenge each other in a primary to face Chelsea Clinton. That race will be covered by Luke Russert's son, and it will probably also, the commentators, Lucianne Goldberg's grandson, and probably Bill Kristol's son-in-law will be opining about this race. And I mean, that look, it's the nepotism, the incestuous nature of this is unbelievable. And this is just like, come on, Bushes, Cheneys, when does it end? And it's not a Republican thing. We have the Kennedy dynasty, and God knows, you know, Hillary Clinton, and it doesn't end. But I have a problem with it. But you know, she moves into the state to run. But here's the problem: there really is no raison d'être for her. That's my fundamental problem.
I just did a Google search, Matt, with the words NZ and bipartisan.
Yeah.
And all this stuff comes up. Warner NZ introduced bipartisan bill to support national parks. Harkin NZ announced bipartisan support for moving forward with education reform. Casey Shewart NZ and Wicker introduced bipartisan bill to help older Americans access care close to family and friends. Where does it stop, Matt?
Well, I know those
Isn't
are really
betraying
egregious...
the conservative cause?
Well, I know those are really egregious things he supported. But... well, look, I mean, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz are teaming with Gillibrand right now on, you know, to eliminate chain in command, chain of command from the U.S. military reporting abuses. So eventually, you know, bipartisanship, I think, you know, is it that bad? Look, here's part of the story. I think that if there was a clear contrast, if Inzi was, you know, egregiously liberal, if he had, you know, made a huge vote for, you know, Obamacare or even the immigration bill, which I support, but that would have at least given a rationale for her candidacy. I don't think that vote exists. There's like a vote on internet taxation or something, which I'm sure some bloggers will be all over, but or he championed that issue. But There isn't the compelling rationale for her candidacy. Like, the only reason she's running, it seems, is because she wants to be a U.S. senator. And look, I mean, I was fully supportive of conservative efforts to remake the U.S. Senate when Marco Rubio ran against Charlie Crist, when Rand Paul ran against Mitch McConnell's handpicked guy in Kentucky. I thought that was really healthy, and I think some of these incumbents had done egregious things like Charlie Crist hugging Barack Obama. And I think, frankly, we needed to send a message and a wake-up call. But I think that message has been sent. And now I think we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel for, you know, rhinos to hunt. NZ doesn't strike me. And I think, you know, National Journal ranked him as like the seventh most conservative senator or something like that. I mean, I'm not prepped on this. Please feel free to contradict me and criticize me in the comment section. Don't quote me on that one, but I don't think he is. In other words, it doesn't make sense to me. It seems like she's just trying to get to the U.S. Senate. What, you know, and why not, if you really want to do something for Wyoming, like move there, live there for a decade, run for the state house, run for the state senate, pay your dues. And, you know, it's not a gender thing. I mean, Mika Brzezinski and others this morning on Morning Joe were saying that, like, if she were a man, we'd be encouraging her for this ballsy move. No, I think it's carpetbaggery. And anyway, so I don't think it's a gender thing.
Eighth most conservative senator in 2012, according to National Journal.
There you go.
So apparently you're willing to settle for number eight. Where's the competitive spirit, Matt?
Exactly. I know we're going to move on, but like, what do you, you know, put yourself in, or if this happened on the Democratic side, if Chelsea Clinton decided she was going to move into Mary Landrieu to move to Louisiana? I mean, she doesn't have.
Well, Landrieu's probably not that as good an example because she does lean right on a number of issues.
Let's say she decided to move to Arkansas. That would be a better analogy. She's going to move to Arkansas and run against an incumbent Democrat. Would you be morally offended by that?
I mean, I'm with you in the terms of, you know, I can't pronounce my French. You need a reason. There needs to be a reason than just beyond, I have a name and I want to do this. You have to give a good reason to the voters of that state that you are a better choice than the incumbent. So I don't think, you know, I'm not into incumbency protection, for incumbency's sake. But if you have someone who's there, who's doing a good job, and, you know, is in sync with your values, is being effective at getting things done, I'm not going to throw that person over the side of the edge just because they've been around for a long time or because I like the other person's name. So I would think Liz Shea would have an uphill road. From all I can tell, Indy's pretty popular in Wyoming. Yeah, I didn't really get a sense there was this groundswell of disgruntlement with how he operates.
It's a solution in need of a problem is what it is, and it doesn't jive. And you know, I haven't spent much time in Wyoming. I don't even think I've been there, but I have spent a lot of time in the Midwest and Plain States, and especially North Dakota. And it's very parochial there. And I know the Cheney name goes a long way, obviously, but they see, you know, the culture there doesn't seem like the kind of culture that would throw out an older incumbent.
I think a smaller rural state that expects, you know, a lot of personal face time.
Yeah.
You know, sense that you're around, you're involved in local issues, you're not just, you haven't gone native, gone Washington. I'm not deeply familiar with NZ's career, but I would bet he knows how to touch his bases in Wyoming because he's been doing it for so long.
He has, Bill, is he, unlike people like Orrin Hatch, who saw this sort of thing coming and prepared, NZ hasn't raised money. And he, I think he is a little fat and happy, a little lazy there. And he should have been raising a lot more money. And it's very likely she will outspend him and outraise him. And he should have worked harder and seen that coming. But look,
he's got time.
He's got time.
It's not that late. And I'm sure he's got enough connections in Washington that he can scrape up some money. And it's not an expensive state to run in. So
that's true.
I'm sure he can get enough to get himself on the air. It's not like he lacks name recognition or anything.
Good point. But I will say this too.
You need to have a ground game.
And about her being more conservative, though, I want to say this perception, and I understand, like, liberals think Dick Cheney's conservative, but he was Gerald Ford's chief of staff. He was
that's useful in discretion. You know, just like anyone, you know, everyone's got a Confederate youth. Everyone has a time in their 30s when they were the White House chief of staff for a squish.
Well, that's a story we didn't talk about last week, is the Rand Paul story about... Yeah, everyone's dabbled in neo-Confederacy. But look, in Dick Cheney, before he picked himself, and by the way, interesting habit of Dick Cheney picking himself to be, you know, George Bush's running mate, and his daughter essentially picking herself with no groundswell that we know of to be a U.S. senator. But, you know, Cheney was beloved by the Washington, D.C. establishment and cocktail circuit, as a congressman and before he became the Veep. And how conservative is he? I mean, if your definition of conservative is growing the executive branch and, you know, bombing Iraq, then, you know, invading Iraq, then he is incredibly conservative.
Well, that might be Liz's definition of conservatism, so she might be in agreement with that.
Yeah, so anyway, I would question the notion that she's... I mean, here's what she is. She's younger. There is a sense it's not about ideology. It's about who is younger and has more energy and is tougher and wants to fight. But if that's what the race is about, she'll probably win.
What I don't understand it, and I've seen this, you know, where I live in Northampton at the local level, not that I'll get into the weeds with, you know, local politics here, but why people can't wait? I mean, you know, why someone can't see, you know, this incumbent is not going to be around forever. There'll be a time this person retires, and this person is in sync with my values and is doing a generally good job. Maybe I'll quibble about this or that, but he's not wildly in opposition to what I want to do. He's 69 years old. Liz is 46 years old. Why not move to Wyoming? spend some time working on some local projects, doing some community fundraising, rebuild a school, rebuild a church, you know, show you got, you know, you're involved at the grassroots level, and wait 6 to 12 years. I mean, what else? It's not like Liz is unemployed, can't feed her family. You know, why does she have to do this now is what I don't understand, when she would actually probably benefit from the time to actually get some, you know, Wyoming cred.
Absolutely, Bill. That's a great point, and I think it speaks to part of the unspoken reason why this bothers me. And I think this is an unconservative phenomenon, whereby we live in a world of instant gratification, and people put their ambition before tradition, before protocol. And now we've gotten to the point where you don't even have to pretend to wait your turn. I mean, it used to be that you sort of held, you know, bit your tongue. You didn't want to wait your turn, maybe. You were ambitious, but you knew that it would be unseemly, and that you couldn't get away with this stuff. And I guess we've arrived at a time in our society where we don't punish or we don't have the social, you know, protocol that would make it unseemly to Bigfoot somebody like this. And so I think that that's one of the things that bothers me, is that this speaks to the changing nature of our society, where young people don't respect their elders, don't wait their turn, and don't feel like they have to pay their dues. They can just muscle their way to the front, and the public... And the public rewards them for it often, and I think that speaks to you know, fundamentally one of my concerns with this.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of times those people get burned. I mean, but for every Barack Obama who finds a way to like find his moment and rocket it to the top, I think you get a lot of people that are caught up in hubris and crash and burn. But you can look at the Barack Obama example. I think that could be me, and this is my time. And why should I have to wait? And you know, I mean, I phrase it a little bit differently. I don't feel like people, you know, I mean, it's not incumbency protection. I don't think you believe in incumbency protection. You know, we don't necessarily have turns, but you at least got to do your due diligence and earn the seat. Prove to the public that you are rooted in the values of the community you're asking to be to represent.
Or absent that, Bill, there should be a compelling ideological reason.
Right.
But
the person in charge is falling down the job either for ideological reasons or for competency reasons. There's got to be a reason to say, fire this guy, not just he's been around too long, because sometimes people who've been around too long are good at their jobs, and you want people who know their way around the place.
I completely agree, and I'm taking notes here because I may write about this and steal some of your ideas.
Oh, by all means. That's what this show is for.
Speaking of writing stuff, you've been writing stuff, lots of stuff. Let's talk about some of that stuff.
Well, I got a piece of it the week today about the filibuster deal, and which I think is potentially a pretty landmark moment in terms of how the Senate operates. We'll see if it has residual effect as far as bipartisan cooperation is concerned. There's only some people talking about it that way, and having this kind of kumbaya session behind closed doors with 98 senators, you know, got some of their bad feelings out. Now they're willing to work better together. We'll see if that actually plays out that way. Though it does make a case for opposition to open meeting law, that closed meetings have their value. But that's not what I wrote about. I wrote about John McCain's role in all this, because McCain has really emerged as perhaps the linchpin to the success of Obama's second term. McCain was singularly important at getting a bipartisan deal on immigration through the Senate. We'll see how it goes in the House, obviously. But he's playing a pretty big public role at the moment, saying if we don't do this, this is going to be the death knell for the Republican Party. He's working with Schumer now on a strategy to pressure the House in kind of a subtle way. And when he came out with that initial deal back in January, Schumer praised him to the skies and really credited McCain with being, the, I think the word was the glue. And now here you are with the Senate deal, which, you know, generally is being talked about as a saving of the institution of the Senate, protecting traditional procedure minority rights. But as far as Obama goes, you know, McCain has now locked in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He essentially forced Republicans to stand down from the fight to completely revamp the law, the Dodd-Frank law that Obama got passed, and completely upend the purpose of that agency. And you also and that's going to impact Obama's financial reform legacy. The National Labor Relations Bureau, which is a new deal agency, not one that Obama created, but a vehicle for Obama to strengthen workplace rights in a way that he really can't get done legislatively. And that body has been rendered neutered ever since Obama did a recess appointment for I believe, two of the people. And that was litigated in the courts, and the federal appeals court said those recess appointments were unconstitutional. That's going to go up to the Supreme Court soon, but it potentially says everything that the NLRB has done since those recent appointments is moot, and all the rulings they've done have frozen labor management disputes. And there was a big ruling that the NLRB did, I think maybe before the recent appointments, I could be mistaken about that, but they were struck down because of quorum issues that was going to make it easier for unions to win elections, make it harder for management to meddle in union elections. And now they can redo that rule because they're going to have a functioning body with quorum. So McCain has really given Obama a big boost in his effectiveness for the second term. And there's other outstanding issues. I mean, McCain was supportive of the background check compromise. There's some talk that it might come up to another vote before the term is out. He's elbowing Cruz and Paul on their attacks on counterterrorism policy. He's mocking them for preventing the Senate from going to a conference committee about budget negotiations. And so this is a complete reversal from the last 4 years, where McCain was in this colossal pout after losing to Obama, and all things that he had been supportive of, immigration reform, climate bill, campaign finance reform, he was stamping his feet and filibustered everything. So for him to pivot like this again, this is sort of, in this sort of second wave of maverickiness, I think may completely change, you know, history's judgment on McCain. If he is seen as the great statesman who got past his defeat and worked with his rival to get things done that he's wanted to get done for a long time, I think history will be very kind to him. If he ended on this bitter, petty note, I think history will be very unkind to him. So I think it's a big deal.
And that may be his calculus. You know, this may be strategic, thinking about his legacy. Who knows? It is interesting. I mean, we were talking earlier about trying to oust incumbents, and obviously McCain had a primary battle where he said, you know, build the dang fence. And now I think
which the bill does. He just followed through on that promise.
So he was his primary opponent. His main primary opponent was J.D. Hayworth, who was a very flawed candidate, in my opinion. One does wonder, had there been a better alternative in Arizona, if they could have taken out McCain, what would have happened there? But yeah, it is interesting. And I think no one else is making this point, Bill, that McCain is doing this. I mean, I think conservatives long ago wrote him off. And so they don't really pay that much attention to him. And it's sort of tired to criticize him. It doesn't drive page views because it's just beating a dead horse, so to speak. So it's interesting that you've kind of cataloged this and chronicled this.
Well, that's an interesting point you make, though. He doesn't his imprimatur on a bill doesn't diffuse the right, doesn't bring the right wing along in the Senate. You know, he doesn't have command of a faction of the party. I mean, he was for the background check bill, and that didn't automatically get that over the hump. So it's not mm-hmm. that simple that he magically makes everything better for Obama. He's still got to work for these things. I mean, Reid Cleveland around McConnell, because for folks who haven't gone that deep in the weeds of the deal that they made, apparently McConnell proposed to Reid, "I'll give you all your nominees, but you have to promise you'll never bring up changing the Senate rules by simple majority ever again." And Reid said, "No deal. I need that in my back pocket to keep you guys in line." So then he went to McCain and said, "Okay, what deal can we do here where I get to keep that in my back pocket?" And that was, "Okay, I'll give you most of your nominees, but you got to swap out the National Labor Relations Board folks, because those are the folks that the Supreme Court said were appointed illegally in the first place." And there's some folks on the left that are still kind of grousing about that part of the deal, which I think is kind of silly. It's pretty even trade. You get to pick two people consulted with the AFL-CIO. It's not like they pick two conservatives. Right. So who cares?
Well, look, this is such inside baseball. And I mean, I'm basically of the position that once you get a horrible president like Barack Obama, you can only expect he will appoint horrible advisors. So that's like baked into the cake. It doesn't bother me that much. But I do think we need to preserve the filibuster so we don't have the tyranny of the majority. And so that happened. But this is all inside baseball, Bill. Not unlike something else out there, a book.
Well, before that was a good
Wait,
segue.
That was a great segue.
I hate to step on a segue. But the point I wanted to make about that was McCain was able to bring about, I believe, 17 senators to end the Cordray filibuster as part of this deal. And I don't think he could have done that without McConnell's tacit blessing, because McCain doesn't have that level of strength in the caucus because he's still seen with suspicion on the right. But it does show that there is this faction of the Senate that wants to do deals, that doesn't want to be nonstop obstructionist. If they wanted, I mean, there clearly was some appetite on the right to let the nuclear option rain down, and then we'll get the Senate in 2014, and then we'll run wild. But I think there is a faction of the Senate, and probably in the House too, that, I mean, this is just my own opinion, I'm speculating here, they're bored. They just don't want to sit there and say no all the time. They're legislators. They want to legislate. They want to do stuff. They want to find problems to solve.
Right.
And McCain gives them an opening to do that. If McConnell's not going to twist the knife and force them to remain in line, McCain and McConnell can do a little dance where McCain sticks his neck out. McConnell keep his head down, not take it on the chin, so he can survive in Kentucky, perhaps not get a primary challenger for his reelection campaign. So that's why I think McCain does matter for Obama. He's a help to Obama, but he doesn't, in and of himself, can't singularly save it, but you need a guy like him to step up and create opportunities.
What's funny, you mentioned the bias toward action that legislators have. And I think it's the book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, where the legislature, there's a third branch whose job is only to get rid of bad laws. They cannot pass anything new. Their entire reason for existence is to get rid of bad laws. So maybe we should consider that.
I mean, that's where I think if those conservatives that are interested in that part of the job should probably, I mean, there probably are laws to be reformed. I mean, there's always deadwood. There's always things that can be made better.
Right.
But there's such an emphasis on let's repeal Obamacare, let's repeal CFPB. You're not going to repeal things that just got done. Why don't you focus on things that were done 30 years ago and show that they aren't working very well and offer some constructive suggestions about that? That might actually be a better way to advance conservatism.
Yeah, but the problem structurally, as you know, I mean, life's, it's about putting points on the board, and your job, if you're a member of Congress, I mean, your job is ostensibly to pass bills. I mean, it's not really, but that's the measurable. And the expression, what gets measured gets done. And so those are the points you put on the board. So if we rethought that entire premise, what if your job was to get rid of bad bills? Like if that was how you would run for reelection saying, I led the effort to get rid of 5 bad bills last year. Reelect me.
I don't see anything wrong with that as an objective, you know, so long as there are good reasons why the bills are seen as bad. It's not just, you know, wanton cutting. Just like I don't think you should be for wanton growing of government. You want to have good reasons for either direction you go in. But I totally think you could run for a re-election on that. But you still have to pass something to repeal a bill or reform a bill. I mean, it still involves action. It's not just sitting around and stamping feet and saying no. It's actually doing something. It's like still looking at a government program and figuring out, okay, is there a better way to do this? And I mean, a better way is eliminating it or reforming it. But I don't see a lot of conservatives in Congress being creative and thinking about those opportunities. They go for the showboat move. I'm going to vote to repeal Obamacare 40 times and not actually work across that, figure out, okay, well, who can I work with to actually do this and actually show some tangible evidence that I'm making government smaller and more efficient.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, too, if you did have a creative, like, if you're lucky, you get one or two of those in a career, you know. It's not like it's amazing in a sense how slow, you know, the big ideas go. If you were to champion some creative effort, you'd be lucky if you got it done, if one of those things done in an entire career. But I'm honest, I got no segues. We can just go to the next topic. What's topic three, Bill? What's topic three?
What do you want to talk, this town or Zimmerman?
Well, let's talk this town, because you wrote about it at The Week. And I suspect that it's the kind of thing that is inside baseball. And, you know, it's not going to get a huge readership, but I suspect some of the people...
I did not.
Some of the people watching us, they're insiders. I mean, if you're... You don't, you know, this... You don't just happen to listen to the DMZ. You know what I'm saying? You got to sort of be in the know to know who we are.
Well, but I think it does relate to what we were just talking about because, so Mark Leibovich, who is the New York Times Magazine feature writer, he's sort of the master of the profile. He's a very entertaining, very funny writer. He has a unique ability to get his subjects to say very embarrassing things about themselves. So this is sort of his tour de force. I believe his first book, This Town, which is a tour through all of the egotism, narcissism, sycophantic behavior, hypocrisy that dominates Beltway culture. And the book officially came out on Tuesday this week. I think some early copies got released. There's some early book reviews about it. As the title of my piece was, Why I Will Not Read This Town, I have not read it. So I took some flack in the comments. How dare you write what's like you haven't read? All I can do is be honest that I haven't read it and explain that I'm basing my opinions on what I read about the book reviews, the excerpts that I've read and such.
Well, I think that's completely fair. If you had written a book review, then pretended that you read it, that would be unethical. But you wrote a piece called Why I'm Not Going to Read, Why I Didn't Read It. That's completely legit.
And you know, my feeling was, one, it's not news to me that any kind of capital city, whether it's the national or state level or local level or whatever, is filled with weird people who are narcissists. That's sort of stock and trade in the political industry. It's attracted to the job. So I'm sure it's a funny book. That I don't dispute, but I didn't feel I was going to learn much from that. And from what I read about, some of the examples that he harps on, you know, he kind of mocks Chuck Schumer for being vain and always wanting to be in front of a camera. He knocks Obama team members for hypocrisy because they said they weren't going to hire lobbyists, and they did hire some with waivers. And now some of the people who said they're going to be all holier than thou are now cashing out and taking big corporate jobs. On number one, I mean, this segs back to the Senate discussion. I respect people that do stuff. That's my criteria. Again, whether you're reforming bad bills or creating new bills, you know, if your heart is in the place of I'm trying to make this government work better and I'm going to slog through all the Washington BS to do it, I have respect for that. I mean, I think Chuck Schumer is a weird, vain person, but that guy is not a show horse. That guy's a workhorse. That guy's doing stuff. He's doing a lot of stuff right now, in fact. So I didn't see the point of like mocking his weird behavior in the book. And there's this overlying theme. This is where you and I might disagree more strongly, Matt. This notion that Obama was sort of empty about change because they haven't changed Washington culture. They've become consumed by Washington culture. They do the same revolving door things that other administrations do. And the two points they made about that was, you know, number one, yes, they hired some lobbyists with waivers, you know, which they announced, so it wasn't a secret. But a number of those cases were completely innocuous. For example, it's not this huge unethical thing to hire the lobbyists for a campaign for tobacco-free kids to be Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services. That's not offensive to me. There are other examples where you might say, okay, well, you hired a lobbyist from Raytheon, a defense contractor, to be a top guy at the Pentagon. Okay, that potentially might have been
right.
A conflict
well,
of interest.
Bill, I'm not surprised you're not upset. This fits into your brand of American greatness. What are we calling it? What are we calling your brand of liberalism?
I mean, you can call it American greatness. You can call it liberal pragmatism.
We need a label. I think we should call upon the commenters to help. You need to brand your, because you have this unique, and I think liberal fascism is probably pejorative, so you might not want to go there, but you have this unique, you've got like, you have a style of liberalism, and I think you need to put a little TM by it, and
right.
Like name it and claim it, and I think that's, you need to market this idea. So let's
I mean, it's probably not the right phrase, but I'm for liberal effectiveness, and the history shows that when you partner with corporate entities, more liberal stuff gets done.
Compassionate conservatism. The name assumes that that implies that liberalism is inherently ineffective. You can't use
well,
that name.
Well, certainly can be. And so here you are. You hired a guy from Raytheon to be in the Defense Department. Well, this sort of smacks of expanding the military-industrial complex. Are you going to curry favors for Raytheon now? They're going to get sweetheart contracts. But that's not what happened. What happened is that the Defense Department's under a sequester. So it's not like... It's not like the military-industrial complex isn't being, you know, shrunken down right now. And having a guy with the experience on both sides of the public-private fence might have facilitated that. So I don't blame folks for raising an eyebrow when it happened. But we've had 5 years of this now, and this is sort of akin to what I said about the drone battle. You know, I understand the nervousness going in, raising the red flags going in. But once you've done it and you've seen how it works. I don't think this means that you throw open the gates and let all the foxes, you know, guard the hen houses.
Yeah.
But to go on a case-by-case basis and say, you know what, this guy's particularly good. He really knows his way around the Pentagon. He really knows the defense budget. He's going to help me. I'm going to make an exception in this case. That to me doesn't undermine the spirit of what Obama was talking about, which is I'm going to end the practice of having the industries patrol themselves and not do a good job patrolling themselves.
Yeah, and I mean the book.
Go ahead.
Well, the book does go after politicians, but there's also, Kurt, who my former colleague here, who used to work for ISA. It talks about Tammy Haddad. I think I'm pronouncing that right. The former producer of Hardball, who's sort of a DC socialite, holds this annual brunch. I think it's the morning of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So it also looks at the sort of other players who make the Washington, D.C. culture and who sort of, you know, where the cool kids kind of go and who they talk to. So, but I haven't read it either, Bill, and I probably won't. But I suspect, you know, there's some good gossip and fun stuff in there. But I think, you know,
I think he's gotten a lot of gossip. I think that's probably going to be its main stock in trade is the gossip.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is, does he have deeper insight? You know, I mean, and it seems like his big insight is that the Obama administration failed to change anything, which I think if your expectation was he was going to change all of Washington culture, that's an unfair standard to judge him. I don't even think he was promising
that. In my opinion, the quixotic voters who bought into the hope and change myth, you know, that's their fault. They should have known better. I mean, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game. I don't really hold that against Obama too much. It was a great line. And a great idea, but I knew that it was going to be politics as usual. I think here's the other thing, though. I think that the stock and trade of the book is gossip. But I think in the old days, you know, Kitty Kelly would write these books about, you know, the Reagans and, you know, what was happening, you know. So, but I feel like in the old days, before the internet, you could have almost a monopoly on gossip if you had some really good sources and you could write a book and sell a lot of copies. I just think in the day of the internet, gossip is so ubiquitous and so that I don't know that it works as well today. And I suspect that some of the best parts of the book have already leaked out. I mean, there was a big New York Times magazine did a big excerpt of it. And other people have read it and immediately read it and reported on some of the juiciest stuff. I don't know if you can sort of hold gossip anymore in a book. Doesn't it just leak out to BuzzFeed 5 minutes after the book comes out?
Well, I mean, that's probably a challenge for him. But I do think, Leibovich is a great writer. He is a funny writer. I can't think of a profile he's written that I didn't enjoy reading. Just the process of reading it is just he's a fun read. So if you know his work from the Times and previously the Washington Post, if you're a Leibovich fan, you might buy the book because you like reading Leibovich, and you won't be driven by just the little, you know, scooplets that come out in the papers. The question is, can you go beyond that pool of people and have it really be a bestseller? That I think I'm not as sure about, but I mean, it's only been marketed as best as you could possibly market. It's got plenty of attention, plenty of FaceTime on TV, and I don't begrudge him that at all. But I do think that I don't like the idea of the notion that Obama hasn't changed anything being sort of accepted as fait accompli, because I feel every reviewer has done that. And just to give one other example here, yes, you can find folks like, you know, Robert Gibbs and David Plouffe, who have left the White House, are now making a lot of money. You know, they haven't taken vows of poverty. They didn't go work for a public service agency or a nonprofit. They're doing quite well for themselves. So that's absolutely true. But I didn't have an expectation that everybody around Obama was going to be pure of heart for the rest of their natural lives. What's notable is they have an executive order in place that was signed on day one that said, after you work in the White House, you can't lobby the White House, period. That for the rest of the Obama administration, you can't do that. You can be a lobbyist. You can go lobby Congress. You can go lobby state governments. But you can't train your personal connections inside the White House and make money off of that. That is actual change. That is different than what any other administration has done. The Bush administration had a one-year cooling-off period, and then you could lobby your own agency you used to work in. So what Obama's doing is different than that. Maybe it doesn't solve every problem with money in politics. Maybe there's more things you have to do. But to say that there's no change, that they're just completely threw their hands up and said, screw it, or they didn't believe it in the first place, that strikes me as a very overbroad conclusion based on a cherry picking of data points.
You need a premise to write a book, and this one's as good as any.
And believe me, there's a lot more cynics out there to buy books than there are optimists like me.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he's made the right bet as far as writing a book is concerned. But I'm going to do my part in shaking my fist to counteract that narrative.
Maybe Sherrian liberalism. How do you like that? Sherrian?
Sherrian, yes.
Sherrian.
I like the sound
Sherrian.
Of that.
I like the
Sher-esque.
So maybe we make that a thing. But sound off in the comments.
Sheritarian? Give you a Sheritarian?
Sheritarian.
It's almost like, communitarian.
Sheritarian. I think I like Sherrian better. But you want to talk about Zimmerman, or do
you just like it because the name sounds German?
Sherry. Yeah. You want to call it a day, or do you want to hit another topic?
Only if you want to talk about your Zimmerman piece.
Let me just tease it. We don't have to get into it, but essentially, I wrote that one of the potential unintended consequences or likely outcomes of the Zimmerman story is that people will think twice before deciding not to mind their own business. And I talk about myself. I mean, I wouldn't have done what George Zimmerman did, because if I saw somebody I thought was suspicious, I would have fled to my house and turned on the TV. And if there was a rash of burglaries in my neighborhood, I wouldn't have joined a neighborhood watch or started it. I would have got a security system. And if they continued, I wouldn't have decided to try to police my own community. I would have moved to a different neighborhood. So, I sort of live this individualistic life, even though I espouse this communitarian worldview. And I suspect that, the whole bowling alone phenomenon, this is just one more reason to, whether you tell your kids or whether you just internalize it, that life is just easier. Look the other way. Don't get that involved. This isn't like, it's not the most important thing that'll come out of this, maybe. It's certainly not the most obvious thing, but I do suspect that if you see something, you're less likely to say something.
I mean, I think there's a middle ground here, whereas you can get involved in your community and not withdraw from society without running around with a gun.
If George Zimmerman, I hear what you're saying, and there certainly is the thing where you just call the police.
Right.
Which is maybe a form of escapism. Or maybe we should be encouraging, hey, man, what's going on? Are you lost? Maybe that's, I'm not sure what the right thing to do is. But I will say this. If George Zimmerman does everything except the gun, he might be dead today.
Well, you wouldn't confront him personally. I mean, yeah, that's not a smart thing to do either. But you could have called in the police.
But why isn't it? Shouldn't you, if you see some, let's say that, I swear this is true. I could come home today and see people I don't know moving my neighbors into a Ryder truck, and I wouldn't say anything, and I wouldn't call the police, and I might offer to help move my neighbor's stuff. That would be the extent of my neighborliness, would be helping rob them inadvertently. But shouldn't I go up and be like, excuse me, these are my neighbors. I'm not aware that they're moving. Shouldn't I, as a responsible citizen, take that step? Or should I just go in my house? I mean, you see what I'm saying? I know it's not a perfect analogy, but...
I mean, I've been in this situation before. I was living in New York, and there was a guy who was clearly walking up and down the fire escape, which is unusual. And you call the police. I didn't go out and say hello to the guy. I don't know what kind of situation I would be walking into. I may be mistelling the story. Maybe someone else did that and I wasn't around. I have bad memories. But someone was on the virus game and someone called the police. That's the point. No one confronted the police.
But if we're going to talk about giving people, take ownership for your community, help this be a better community, is the extent of our involvement dropping the dime on somebody, being a snitch? I mean, is that the most we should do as neighbors, is just to call the police? Shouldn't we? Now, again, I wouldn't get involved. I would not, because I think it's a hassle, because I don't want to get beat up. I don't want to be involved in a lawsuit. I don't want to be in a confrontation. My life is easier by looking the other way, and so that's what I do. But shouldn't we as a society be more involved in helping police our own communities?
I see nothing wrong with a system where you have hired professionals with weaponry that go into those dangerous situations. You don't expect individuals to walk into a dangerous situation blindly and let things get out of hand. That's a proper division of labor, as far as I'm concerned.
Should we completely outsource, our communities to the professionals? The police.
I mean, the police can't be everywhere all the time.
Right.
If you see something, say something is a perfectly responsible credo to follow. But it's not if you see something, confront them and shoot them. It's if you see something, say something, and then get out of the way.
I don't think he can correct it. No, but here's, I think he probably did say something. I think Zimmerman, we don't know what happened, but I suspect he followed him and said, hey, do you live here? What are you doing here? And Trayvon probably was offended by that. Like, who the hell are you? Are you the police? Why are you asking me that? And I might have done the same thing if I were him. I would have been like, who are you? Who are you to ask me why I'm here?
I mean, there's no evidence that he saw Trayvon in the act of a crime that he tried to stop.
No. I agree. But he thought that it was suspicious. And that gets into the whole profiling thing. And we could get into a whole nother discussion. But my thing here is, I think that this case will, one of the outcomes will be that it will discourage people from saying something. I think the message is mind your own damn business, and there'll be less problems.
I think the lesson can be a little bit more careful in how you go about being helpful to your community. There are constructive ways. There are not constructive ways. I don't feel less inclined. You know, if I saw something suspicious in my neighborhood, I wouldn't go, you know, hide, not tell anybody. I wouldn't go out waving a gun doing it, but I would call somebody. I would try to do what I could within the realms of safety and responsibility to help.
Right, but I think that speaks to my point, which is to say that the extent of our neighborliness and citizenship is to drop a dime on somebody. We're not going to get involved. We're not going to put ourselves in peril. We're not going to even ask questions. We're not going to physically go up and be like, sir, can I help you? We've had, you know, a rash of burglaries here. You know, I just, you know, and I've had that happen to me, by the way. And I was offended. You know, one time I was lost and disoriented, and I pulled over, and I think I probably had a Grateful Dead bumper sticker on my car at the time.
Well, you were asking for it then.
And some people knocked on my window and were like, what are you doing here? And they were the neighborhood watch, and they said that they had you know, that they had problems in the neighborhood in the past. And I've had this happen to me a few times, that sort of thing. And it's weird. And I got the hell out of there. But, you know, like, if they had caught me, usually they surprise you, and they usually have a really bright light shining in your car, and you can't see what they're doing. It's very scary and intimidating. But, I mean, it's possible. If they had caught me at the wrong time, I might have taken a swing at them. Who knows? So I know people will beat me up for saying this, but in a way I can identify more with Trayvon in this situation. And I know there's a lot of history there, but I can identify more with Trayvon in a sense than I can with George Zimmerman, because I would have never done what George Zimmerman did. He was obviously overzealous. He was obviously a wannabe cop. But having said all that, I do think that there is a subtle message that you're better off not being too involved in your community. Let somebody else deal with it. Call the cops at most, but don't be a hero. Don't be too concerned.
Well, while we leave it on that note,
yes.
Good to have you back. Back from Hollyweird.
Yeah.
From Bill Maher.
I got one more trip this summer, but back from the left coast, and happy to be back. Good to see you.
You too. I got to take a break in later in August. I get a little Rhode Island respite awaiting me, but we got a few more shows before then.
Sounds good. We'll tune in next week and. Let us know your what you want to call Sharian liberalism. Sound off in the comments.
All right. Take care.
All right. Thanks.